dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the wonderful things about this program is it allows me to reconnect every once in a while with old friends and colleagues, men that I have known for many years and have admired as a duty expert, in particular on some of the really important issues involving the nexus of international economics and national security policy, is William Hawkins. He formerly served with Congressman Duncan Hunter, who went on to become the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. That would be Duncan Hunter Sr., of course. He also served as a professional staff member on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. These days, he is a consultant specializing in that nexus of economics and the national security. And he caught my eye with a piece that will be published shortly in the Journal of Political Risk about the Defense Production Act of 1950, which would seem to be a pretty exotic subject, and yet it's very relevant to a hearing that's taking place, well, in the course of the day today, as a matter of fact. As we speak, it's in the future, but as this program airs, it will have happened in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee under the chairmanship of Senator James Risch of Idaho, that will be looking at the requirements for the United States in a new era of competition with Communist China. The man who I hope will be called for his expertise in future hearings of that committee is Bill Hawkins. Bill, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. So good to have an excuse to reconnect with you.
Oh, glad to be here.
So tell us a little bit about the Defense Production Act of 1950. Obviously, Bill, that was something that was enacted in a very different moment. We faced the growing realization that the Soviet Union was a present danger. What was in that act? What does it empower the president to do? And very briefly, how should it be applied in our own time, and specifically in regards to the present danger of our time, namely from China?
Yeah, obviously, it drew on the experience we had as the arsenal of democracy in World War II, and that we're going to be facing a new challenge from the Soviets. And we're going to have to meet it in more or less the same way, a strong economic base from which our military power and political influence would come from. And it's, it was done in 1950, and it seems like a long time ago, but it was reauthorized as recently as 2014. And it's got an office in the Pentagon run by the Assistant Undersecretary of Defense for Industrial Policy. Overseas. So it's still on the books. And that's the key thing, because President Trump is, doing a lot of things by executive authority here. And the Congress isn't in much of a state to operate coherently on anything at the moment. So we have to look for laws that are already on the books, and authorities that already exist and have been around a long time to have legitimacy. And this act does that, because it not only looks at defense industry. I mean, the key here is it doesn't narrowly define defense. It defines the defense industry very broadly, and includes, even in one phrase of it, the general economic well-being of the United States, which essentially covers everything.
It does.
And that's the kind of competition we're in with China economically, because the Chinese have gotten their supply chains into our economy everywhere.
No, that's for sure, including in the defense sector, I'm shocked to say, but it's a very real concern to those of us who are following this closely. Bill Hawkins, you mentioned the Chinese in our supply chains for our economy. That, unfortunately, as you know so well, is true to some extent, at least, in our defense sector's supply chains, which is potentially a very serious problem for the national security. But I did want to just ask you, you mentioned the focus on sort of the economic strength of the United States, but the Defense Production Act, as I recall, specifically focused on sort of the need for a defense industrial base to be quite robust, one of the lessons of World War II, of course, and the Cold War. Would you talk a little bit about the condition of the defense industrial base, or the industrial base of the country, for that matter, more broadly, as it is needed for the national security, especially vis-a-vis what China has been doing to build up its industrial capacity and shipbuilding and so much more?
Well, yes. The industrial base, as I said, was not – the strength of this act is that it does not define the defense industry narrowly, because the defense industry is no longer a narrow or little sector off by itself. More and more, because the commercial sector is the base of innovation, the defense industry is buying things essentially off the shelf from commercial producers. They're outsourcing a great deal of stuff. The major defense companies are less manufacturers than they are buyers of parts that then assemble. And that those parts come from all over the economy. And that's where the Chinese supply chain problem comes. Not directly into, say, Boeing doesn't directly, or the Pentagon doesn't directly buy things from China, but Boeing might, because Boeing has a lot of operations in China. Or some of the subcontractors down the line. When I was working for Hunter, the Armed Services Committee, we kept trying to get the Pentagon to look into this and to give us a report on what the subcontractors down, two or three levels down, where they're getting their material, where they're getting their technology, where they're getting their parts. And we could never get a very good answer for that. And that was quite a while ago. It's only gotten worse since.
I'm afraid. And you know, you look at companies like Huawei and the Chinese telecommunications, which have been embedded in all kinds of places, including, I think, probably some with defense applications. It's a very alarming situation. Bill, just very quickly in summation, we're going to run out of time here momentarily, but what is the single most important insight and recommendation you would give President Trump in this space, specifically with respect to the Defense Production Act of 1950?
Well, it gives him the power to do just about anything that can be tied to national security. And his whole trade policy with China, putting the tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese exports, that was rooted in national security policy, the fact that they steal so much of our technology. So what we have to do is really not make a trade deal in the sense that we're going to increase our commerce with China, which is what a lot of people in the business community want the trade deal to do. We need a deal that essentially cuts off our ties to China in strategic industries and bring those back here.
He seems keen on that. I don't know whether this trade deal is going to do it or not, but we're going to have you back, Bill, I hope, to discuss that deal as it becomes a little clearer what exactly is involved and what the downside risks of focusing too narrowly might be when a holistic approach to China is clearly needed. But thank you for your time today, and thank you for this important forthcoming piece at the Journal of Political Risk on the Defense Production Act of 1950 and the authorities that gives the President of the United States to do what must be done. We'll talk with you again very soon, Bill. Thank you for your time today. Next up, Diana West joins us. We'll talk about the red thread and the hacking at the DNC. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by Diana West, a marvelous contributor to, well, the public policy debate about both the national security, our history, our culture, and so much more. She is to be found these days at dianawest.net and also in places like The Daily Caller and Epoch Times. And there's an important piece she wrote this week on the latter that we'll be discussing. But I also wanted to commend her for the publication and rollout last week, very successfully, of her new book from the Center for Security Policy Press, The Red Thread, The Search for ideological drivers in the anti-Trump conspiracy. Diana, it is so good to have you back. Congratulations on last week, a terrific interview that we did both on air here at Secure Freedom Radio and the Facebook Live video that featured yourself and Chris Farrell and Rich Higgins. It was a most impressive and I gather has had some pretty good feedback.
Yes, thank you. It was a wonderful launch. And I was happy to say that the book has been an Amazon hot release in communism and socialism ever since, pretty consistently at number one and number two. So we've had a good launch.
Wonderful. Well, it should be, needless to say, required reading for all of us who've been tracking what's been going on with this this conspiracy to prevent Donald Trump from becoming president in the first instance and then undermining his transition to the presidency and to sap wherever possible and sabotage his time in office. And Diana, one of the things that is particularly relevant to what I wanted to talk to you about today against the backdrop of this seeming collapse on Brexit in the United Kingdom is the kind of power that the global elites have been exercising, many of them with Marxist tendencies or even, you know, predilections, the sorts of things that you document as the ideological drivers behind sort of the now well-documented effort to defeat this counter-revolutionary Donald Trump. But talk to us a little bit about the antecedents here, the role that people like Alger Hiss and Harry Dexter White played in fashioning what we think of as the global world order that has spawned so many of these global elites and their tendencies.
Yes, well, it's a very important subject that somehow is not at everyone's fingertips in terms of the structure of this so-called global order, new world order, liberal international order, which we've been beset by since World War II, was set in place. The structures that created it were literally set in place by important senior American government officials who were later exposed to having been working for the Soviet Union the whole time. That would be Alger Hiss, very senior State Department official, also Soviet agent, who was the godfather of the United Nations from the American side, and Harry Dexter White, very senior Treasury official, all during the Roosevelt administration and World War II, who presided over the creation of the global monetary system at the IMF. He was indeed the first head of it, and he too, a Soviet agent. So when we look at this, what we consider to be a liberal order, it's not liberal at all. It is a structure to create a global government, which was part and parcel of the Soviet communist, Marxist, socialist plan. And these two incredibly important actors are just two of the many, many affiliates and assets of communism who were creating this enterprise, which is strangling all of our nations.
And Diana, you document this so brilliantly in your book, American Betrayal. And one of the things that was particularly heartening about the comments that Chris Farrell and Rich Higgins made about your new book, The Red Thread, was how brilliant that earlier work was and how important it is to understanding some of the insights that you've developed in terms of similar kinds of, well, Marxist and hard left, at a minimum, sort of tendencies on the part of the architects, if I can use that expression, of this effort to destroy Donald Trump in our own time, in today's government, or certainly the government of Barack Obama. And Diana, I think this is just an important opportunity to plug the book. Of course, people can get it at Kindle. They can get it at Amazon. They can even download it for free at the Center for Security Policy as a PDF. But it's really required reading, as I say, to understand what we're confronting at the moment. As is a piece that you wrote, as I mentioned earlier, in the Epoch Times earlier this week, I believe, or last week now, that drilled down very helpfully in an example of the big lie, as you call it, that we have been treated to as sort of a central tenet of this anti-Trump conspiracy. Walk us through what we know about the actual nature of the hacking of the Democratic National Committee's servers, long and insistently attributed to the Russians?
Yes, well, we don't know much about hacking. We know much more about leaking. And what I mean by that is that the conventional wisdom at this point, which is being pummeled and just beaten into us, is that the Russians hacked, in other words, from the outside world, hacked these Democratic National Committee servers. And all these terrible things happened as a result of the Russians working in collusion with the Trump team to destroy Hillary Clinton. This is the fairy tale that we are constantly treated to without evidence. When I say without evidence, I literally mean without evidence, indeed, including the fact that our own FBI never, ever had control of the DNC servers to perform any sort of testing. So we were left to Debbie Wasserman Schultz and her team and the people at Perkins Coie, who were the counsel for the DNC, to rely on their word that the contractor that they hired, a company called CrowdStrike, co-founded by a Russian expatriate, by the way, performed all the necessary tests to establish that the Kremlin was responsible. No one has seen this evidence for themselves. We only have their word. So this becomes absolutely an outrageous piece of a fantasy that we have now been trying to see the world act on, and it's part of the entire conspiracy against the Trump presidency. So this is an important piece that continues to be hammered, and we saw it in these hearings when Debbie Wasserman Schultz, again in her questioning of Michael Cohen, reprised this nonsensical point. And the other side of it is that the only kinds of forensic evidence that has come out, that has been presented, comes from a team of former national security and intelligence world officials, including the very senior, very prestigious William Binney, who used to be a technical director at the National Security Agency, and indeed created a number of these data collection systems that are still being used. He and a team of ex-officials looked at what they could in terms of what has been released, and their best analysis is that according to different sorts of speeds and other kinds of technical evidence that they have looked at and tests that they have run themselves from various parts of the world, they have determined that this was indeed an internal leak. In other words, someone inside the DNC took these emails and brought them out and was the source for WikiLeaks. This has been essentially confirmed by Julian Assange, who has indeed very closely, very strongly suggested that the murdered DNC official Seth Rich was the source of these emails for WikiLeaks.
Yeah. He has suggested that. I think it's important to say he hasn't confirmed it exactly. But just a couple of details here, Dinah. Perkins Coie, if I understand things correctly, was also the firm that was used by the Hillary Clinton campaign to sort of launder the money on the dossier by Christopher Steele. Is that right? So, I mean, these are not exactly disinterested parties that we should take at their word. And I just have to say, Diane, I mean, the thing that has blown my mind about this all along is I can't think of another instance. There may be others, but certainly none come to mind, in which the Federal Bureau of Investigation would take the word of some third party with respect to a vitally important piece of forensic information. And yet that seems to be what they did here. Now, would that perhaps have been a decision made by, James Comey or Andrew McCabe, for example, or people at other senior levels who have also been implicated in this conspiracy against Donald Trump? I mean, the thing stinks to high heavens, for heaven's sakes.
Absolutely. This is exactly true. And if you watch James Comey's old testimonies, I believe he discussed this four times on four separate occasions in Congress when he was testifying about these matters without any concern or hesitation, just treating it as absolutely business as usual. We also have the fact that another CrowdStrike co-founder, Sean Henry, is somebody who has a long tradition at the FBI and indeed with these same characters, including Robert Mueller. I mean, the conflicts of interest don't stop with these people.
Yeah. And John Brennan, I think, was another who has been very insistent in promoting this idea that the proof is absolutely dispositive that the Russians hacked these servers. And, you know, one other piece of this, which, again, may or may not factor in, Seth Rich seems to be, you know, an obvious suspect, but I do think it's important, as our friend Luke Rosiak has pointed out in his new book, Obstruction of Justice, which he dissects brilliantly, the Pakistani nationals ring that were operating inside the wire of the House of Representatives on behalf of, among others, Debbie Wasserman Schultz. And when I say among others, I mean among other members of the Democratic caucus in the House, providing their IT services for years. We have to leave it at this, I'm afraid. But thank you for this excellent piece at Epoch Times. I commend it to all of our listeners and for the great work you've done with The Red Thread and, of course, American Betrayal and Death of the Grown-Up and so much more. Thank you for joining us. As always, we'll look forward to further visiting with you next week.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined by one of my favorite people, Thomas Popick. He is the chairman of an incredibly important group, the Foundation for Resilient Societies, trained at MIT as an undergrad and at the Harvard Business School for his MBA. He brings an extraordinary degree of expertise and insight and acumen to bear on, well, any subject he turns to. But we've asked him to join us today to speak about the now unfolding catastrophe, and I use that term advisedly, in Venezuela. What has been a dismal situation for years under the Chavez and now Maduro regimes has gone hypercritical with the blackout over much of the nation that began last Thursday and that continues substantially undiminished as we speak. Tom Popick, you have been studying what's going on there, and I'm very, very appreciative of you taking some time to talk to us about it, specifically with respect to the question of, was this, as Nicolas Maduro claims, the result of an American attack using cyber warfare against the grid of Venezuela? Welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Frank. I really appreciate the opportunity to explain what's happening in Venezuela. Just to back up, on March 7th of this year, there was a cascading outage that hit Venezuela at approximately 5 p.m. This last Thursday. 22 of 23 Venezuelan states were taken offline. Since then, there has been a number of restoration attempts, and there's been setbacks, too. There's been catastrophic loss of load during the restoration process. At this point, most of the load has been restored, but it's still a very tricky and risk-fraught situation. In regard to this idea that somehow a U.S. cyber attack caused this blackout, I think the chance of that is exceedingly low, and there's many other more reasonable explanations for what went on. But I would just say up front, it would probably be against U.S. interests to cause a blackout in Venezuela, because that could result in a big refugee migration northward. It's much better to keep the power on in Venezuela for U.S. interests. So I just don't think that the cyber attack idea is accurate.
Is credible, yeah. And Tom, there's several things you said that I want to drill down on, but maybe just to begin with, where did the cascading collapse start? And again, is there a reason to believe that it was cyber that prompted it?
First of all, we have to understand that in blackout conditions, the investigation and the information flow is very limited, and especially under the current Maduro regime, they would have an interest in not letting information get out. So we do not know the real cause of the blackout. Having said that, there's been analysis by engineers familiar with the Venezuelan grid, as well as investigation by reporters. It appears that one or more of the 765 kilovolt transmission lines from the Guri Dam to the Western Population Centers tripped off, causing what's called a system disturbance, and there's a certain cascade effect. It's like an avalanche going downhill. Once a major transmission line is lost, the power can back up and then trip off other transmission lines. This happens in electric grids that don't have a cyber attack at all. So I think that's really probably the most feasible or the most probable scenario.
Okay. And I understand that it appears that the turbines, or at least some of the turbines at the Guri Dam, have been damaged as well, and that facility's productive capacity, a very important hydropower facility in the Venezuelan grid, has been adversely affected as well. Is that right?
That's what we hear reported in the press. We don't have confirmation that the turbines have been damaged at the Guri Dam. However, there's a well-developed body of technical literature that are under conditions of what is called load rejection that turbines can catastrophically fail. For example, there was a power plant in Russia in 2009 that had a load rejection or loss of consumer load. It resulted in an explosion, a failure, a catastrophic failure, and an explosion at that power plant that took it totally offline and killed 75 people. It's certainly not beyond the realm of technical possibility for the grid collapse in Venezuela to have shortened the life or even taken offline some of the turbines at the Guri facility, but we simply don't have confirmation of that.
Yeah. Tom, I know you're being very careful here not to overstate the problem, but I did want to just ask about this idea that the load has been generally restored, I think you said. I have been given to understand that between evident damage to at least some of the transformers in the grid and possibly these turbines, that the efforts to restart, black start as they call it, the grid of Venezuela has actually resulted in more unbalanced loads being distributed and more damage done to the infrastructure that the people of Venezuela rely upon. I think you've said 90% or so of the population of Venezuela is in urban centers and are therefore desperately dependent upon electricity to provide the basic services for life. Talk a little bit about what you understand is the current status of the grid and of those people in the cities that depend upon them.
Certainly. We have good instrumentation of the state of the Venezuelan grid, and it's through internet infrastructure, which is dependent on grid power. There are monitoring services that constantly probe internet routers and servers all over the world. They use tools such as ping and trace route. The responses from these pings will let you know whether that equipment is functioning, i.e. whether it has power. So we can see the progression of the Venezuelan blackout using these internet monitoring services. And currently, it looks like about two-thirds of the internet equipment in Venezuela is back online. And that corresponds well with public statements by government officials late yesterday that much of the power had been restored. So not all of the power, but a good amount of the power has currently been restored. The real question is, though, when will the next widespread blackout occur? Because there have been persistent and widespread blackouts since the government takeover of the electricity sector in 2007.
And in part, as I understand it, Tom Popick of the Foundation for Resilient Societies, that's a product of incompetence or mismanagement or simply deferred maintenance on some of these key assets. And again, folks, the nature of these things is that these transformers, these turbines are very, very difficult to replace, even if you have the money to do it. And that's another problem for the Venezuelan government at the moment, is it not, Tom?
Well, that is absolutely correct. This electric grid equipment isn't made in Venezuela. It has to be imported. Much of it is long lead time items. For example, it can take over a year to get a replacement transformer manufactured and replaced. We see reports on Twitter and the news of transformers exploding at grid substations. Why is this happening? It's because they're overloaded during this emergency condition. The overloading causes shortened transformer life, and in many cases, catastrophic explosions and fires. So yes, the grid under stress in Venezuela is failing actually as we speak, and that's producing a much more challenging situation for the country.
Yeah, that's an understatement of epic proportions, I think. Let's just talk about the other key point you made, which I think we very much need to have in mind, the consequences of this, of a lack of power, particularly in urban settings, which make them habitable, basically, is beginning already to have a profound effect, as I understand it, on life there, including, you know, people reportedly desperate for water, drinking from polluted rivers, and even sewage, if that can be contemplated. And otherwise, you know, rioting or you know, simply stealing what they need to try to get food and such to survive. Tom Popeck, in these circumstances, it is absolutely bankable that lots of them will do what some 3 million Venezuelans have already done, is it not? Namely, that they will flee the country, and some of them doubtless will wind up heading here.
I think it's clear that if the conditions persist, if the blackouts persist, there will be large refugee migrations. The most probable pathway is westward over the Colombian border and then potentially northward into Panama. The problem is that the population of Venezuela is 33 million, again, with 90% in urban centers. The population of Colombia is only 50 million. For Panama, it's 4 million. These disproportionately large migrations out of Venezuela could have dramatic effects on these societies and ultimately cause people to arrive at the U.S.-Mexican border.
Yeah. Well, as I say, I think it's no exaggeration to talk about this in terms of a catastrophe, if not one that is upon us, one that is predictably coming. We have to leave it at that. Tom Popeck, thank you for the incredibly important work you do at the Foundation for Resilient Societies. Keep up the good work, my friend. Come back to us soon.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, unquestionably one of the country's preeminent authorities on, well, quite a number of matters, as a matter of fact, but most especially on the condition of America's electric grid and the threats to it, as well as more generally, what we need to do to protect ourselves in that space, but more generally, from nuclear threats that we are increasingly, I'm afraid, being subjected to by not just the Russians and Chinese, but the North Koreans, and presumably in short order by the Iranians and perhaps others. Peter Pry is the executive director these days of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security, a congressional commission. He is also a director of the U.S. Nuclear Strategy Forum, a very prolific contributor to the public policy debate, drawing upon his experience as a member of the staff of the Congressional EMP Commission and the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, professional staff member on the House Armed Services Committee, and his service at the Central Intelligence Agency before all of that. He's the author of numerous books, including, to just cite one, Apocalypse Unknown, the struggle to protect America from an electromagnetic pulse catastrophe and electric Armageddon. Peter Pry, it's good to have you back, sir. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to join us. Peter, I just spent some time in the previous segment talking with our colleague Tom Popick about this situation in Venezuela. I guess I'd like to get your thoughts on it very quickly, but most especially with a view to insights into what is playing out there in the wake of the nationwide blackout that has afflicted the country and is continuing to varying degrees at the moment, for our own efforts to make sure that we're not subjected to a similar kind of problem as a result of the lack of resiliency of our electric grid.
Venezuela should be an object lesson for us about protecting our own grid, because the Venezuelan grid depends on hydroelectric power much more so than the United States. And hydroelectric power is one of the safest, most resilient forms of energy. And through sheer mismanagement, they've managed to create an existential threat to their own country through their blackout. They've only been in blackout since Friday, and people are already drinking from the sewers. And that's with an electric grid. They started off with an electric grid, and it didn't require a foreign attack to bring their grid down. It was just mismanagement by the Venezuelan government. So our grid is potentially much more vulnerable to attacks, and I would add also potentially vulnerable to mismanagement. If some of the crazy New Green Deal policies are implemented that would try to change the way we do energy in this country.
Yeah, that's a very important point, and we haven't really addressed that on this program, but we will in the days ahead, Peter Pry. Speaking of which, there is a report in the offing, we're told, by the Electric Power Research Institute, a sort of project of the electric utilities, that will essentially challenge some of the work that you and your colleagues have done really quite impressively over 17 or so years in the Electromagnetic Pulse Threat Commission chartered by the Congress. Tell us about this EPRI study that we're anticipating will, I guess, once again, suggest that there's really no problem with the resiliency of the grid, even against powerful electromagnetic pulse attacks.
The ballyhooed study by the Electric Power Research Institute is old wine in new bottles. They've basically been saying the same thing, using the same arguments for several years now. And in fact, I think it was back in 2012 when they first broached the theory to me about, well, could it work this way? Could an EMP, for example, if we were talking about the short wavelength EMP, the E1 EMP, could it actually shut down the grid and cause only a temporary blackout? So in effect, the grid would be saved by the fact that it would knock out data systems and cause a blackout before more widespread serious damage could be done. Sort of equivalent to saying, well, could the wheels fall off an airplane before it starts taking off the runway so that you can avoid a catastrophic crash later on? And that kind of reasoning is very dangerous reasoning to base the national security of your country. The people who are authoring this report, the EMP Commission has rebutted this, by the way. We did a 2017 report that has rebutted this EPRI report. The people who are writing it are non-experts. They've never worked for the defense or intelligence community on electromagnetic pulse or defending against electromagnetic pulse. So really, they're practicing national security without a license. And this is junk science study. It's equivalent to what the cigarette industry did back in the 50s and 60s when they had independent laboratory analyses proving that there was no linkage between smoking and lung cancer. EPRI, I would point out, is bought and paid for by the electric power industry. They're not a truly independent laboratory. They basically serve the powers of the electric power industry and are always ready to provide what sounds like a technical or scientific rationalization so that the electric power industry doesn't have to spend money on not just EMP, but on cyber threats, even on tree branch threats. You know, when the Great Northeast Blackout of 2003 was caused by a falling tree branch, organizations like EPRI helped the NERC make the case that, well, you know, let us develop a better plan. It took them a decade to develop an allegedly better tree branch plan.
Vegetation management rule, as I recall. Yeah, it's still outrageous. And Peter, again, you and your colleagues, led by Dr. Bill Graham on the EMP Commission, done such important work raising the alarm about vulnerabilities that can and really must be mitigated far, far faster than over a decade. But I did want to just tie in something else, Peter, because another area of your profound expertise involves our capacity to deter attacks on this country, specifically nuclear attacks. And you've made the observation that one of the problems that we face as a nation, especially in the, as is the case now, the expectation that there'll be more of this sort of nothing to see here folks move along kind of dismissal of the EMP Commission's work by this group EPRI, is the lack of a really serious, competent, and properly grounded government agency like the old Defense Nuclear Agency, which understood and really specialized in weapons effects like EMP and used nuclear underground testing to refine our knowledge and use actual experimentation to validate our concepts. That went away now decades ago. The testing in 1992, I'm not sure quite when the DNA, the Defense Nuclear Agency, went down. But Peter, talk a little bit about that and the cumulative effects on our competency in nuclear deterrence that has been the result.
Well, you touch it with a needle, Frank. The Defense Nuclear Agency had been the premier agency for studying nuclear effects and training and educated military officers, and really providing scientific expertise throughout the U.S. government wherever it was needed to understand nuclear effects, whether it's EMP or blast or radioactive kinds of effects that would be generated from EMP. Now, the Clinton administration was extremely anti-nuclear. Even before Obama, you know, they basically wanted to follow a policy what amounted to unilateral nuclear disarmament through the Stockpile Stewardship Program, where we ceased testing nuclear weapons. And I think the hidden hope, you know, was that that without testing, eventually our arsenal would lose credibility and become obsolete. And a lot of scientists, increasing number of them, agree with that assessment. Clinton replaced the Defense Nuclear Agency with the Defense Threat Reduction Agency, which had a much more broader agenda. You know, the Defense Threat Reduction Agency doesn't focus on nuclear weapon effects anymore. They deal with all kinds of threats, chemical, biological, and natural, including climate change. Climate change is a big deal for DITRA and for the national laboratories. You know, a lot of people think that the national labs, Los Alamos and Livermore, were or are the locus of expertise on nuclear effects, but that was never true. The national labs were just focused on building nuclear weapons, designing and building nuclear weapons.
Peter, there's so much more here to talk about, and we are just hard out of time. Thank you so much for your time today and for the great work you do. I know you'll keep it up, and we'll talk with you again in the very near future.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.